Good morning. We're having an interview this morning. It'll be a joint interview, and I'll have the two people who have kindly consented to be interviewed introduce themselves in just a moment. But it is December 13th, 2010, and we are conducting this interview in a nice, lovely Christmas decorated apartment in the South Ward of Thunder Bay. So maybe Mrs. Irwin, we'll start with you and have you introduce yourself.
Well, I'm Mrs. Margaret Irwin, Bob Irwin, whom we are going to be talking about, is my husband, and due to illness, he's not able to be here.
And just introduce who you are.
I'm Keith Randall. I drove truck for Bob Irwin for many years.
Starting
1956 to when did I retire? 73?
Oh, yeah, 73.
Fall of 73.
Fall of 73. I'm just going to move this microphone a little bit closer to you, okay? Because we can actually share this one. Mm-hmm. So sure. We've got good women's voices. We're used to being understood. Mm-hmm. So, just before the interview, Mrs. Irwin, we were talking a little bit about the history of the Irwin Company, and we haven't even said what the Irwin Company does. So, tell us what was the official name of the company, your husband's company, and what kind of work did they do related to the grain trade that we're talking about today?
Well, actually, it originated back in Emerson, Manitoba, where his grandfather wasn't. He was involved with a company out there, and he always felt as though Thunder Bay was going to be the key place for all the grain to be shipped. And at this point, he felt that the best thing to do would be to move to Thunder Bay and try and establish elevators and capacity to carry and hold the grain for the shipping. Being at the head of the Great Lakes, he figured it was an ideal spot. So anyway, which he did, and he came down here, and he was married, and he had his family. But he really was quite interested in the Cam River more than anything else. So the two elevators on the Cam River, I'm not too sure whether it's the Great Western or one of the elevators up there on the Cam River.
One close to the Great Lakes.
Mm-hmm. Next to the swing bridge, not too far. Just before you get to Patterson's, as you're coming up the river.
Hmm? Ogilvy?
No, not that way. So anyway, he decided to this would be an ideal spot, being in the river and being protected, because they didn't at that time have a break wall across the front of the lakeside. So he did arrange to have the one built, and then he said, well, one isn't going to be enough. He says, I think we should build two. So he didn't build, he didn't, I think he had some involvement with the second one, I'm not too sure, but my husband's uncle was superintendent of one of the elevators there, John. And then as they started commercially building elevators, they built the Searle elevator, and my husband's father was the superintendent of that elevator. So then came one day, of all the concrete that was going into these elevators, the father decided that, you know, he said, son, I think we should try and see if we can't start up a ready-mix concrete business in order to supply the elevators with concrete. So he said, so he did. He went, he was only 16, I think, when he went down to New York to pick up a cement truck. And Then when he came back, he ran the plant for a while, then Permanent Concrete became interested, so they kind of backed him up. And so they, then this is, I think, the beginning of starting of all these elevators, really started the Empire, I think, was one of the originals too. But then they started building up the elevators, and the more elevators they had available, the more grain was brought in from the west, and they had the storage areas. And even during the war, they were building storage bins, and I know because my husband had to pour the base for the storage bins to go on because they didn't have enough space to store the grain, because there was so much grain being shipped overseas at that time that they needed to get all the grain they could possibly bring in. So from there, I think that eventually it became quite a hustle bustle here. So he did well, you know, I mean, in knowing, and with his father and his uncle into the grain business, they were able to guide him and direct him as to whether they should be setting up more elevators or not, you know, but he was too busy pouring, so he didn't have that chance.
Let me just go back to some of the things you've said, a lot of information in a very short time. So if I've got this right, your husband's grandfather was the first one to come here, and he came here already with a family.
Yes.
So, and there were how many?
Oh, dear. I know there was one girl.
One girl?
One girl, and I think it was, four or five boys? Four or five boys. John Stewart, Leslie.
John's the only one.
And I think there were four, I think there were five boys and one girl.
And were all of the boys involved in the family business?
No, they weren't. One was sold cars, and Dick, it was one of them. One of them I know had a dealership, the cars, and the other, two of them were supervisors of elevators, and one was, but he didn't stay there very long. But those were the only two that really did stay to the end of the grain business until they ran, and they either passed away or.
Mm-hmm. So when you say that they were superintendents of the grain business, I guess I'm just a little unclear here. So your husband's grandfather, he was involved in the actual construction of the elevators.
Yes, of the one, and the two, the second one is partly, you know, he didn't completely operate that one, but he did oversee it.
So he was involved in overseeing the construction of it, but they actually ran them mm-hmm. once they were up and operating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and one of his sons then,
John,
was involved at Searle as the superintendent there.
Yeah, that was Bob's father.
Yes.
Leslie.
Okay, so I'm thinking of the son of the original guy who came here.
Mm-hmm.
So which one was your husband's father?
Leslie.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when you said your husband was the one who got started in the concrete business itself, and he was the one who was 16 and went down to
New York.
Yeah. So just setting up some time frames here.
Mm-hmm.
We had a tour of one of those elevators, Western Grain Products, I think is what you're speaking of, but we can confirm all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one was built in 1912. So that would have, that would be about right.
Mm-hmm.
And when was your husband born?
He was born in 1930.
Okay.
They were born here.
And so that we can, 1946 then, he went to New York to pick up the, or just after the war.
Yes. No, it was before the war.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we need to get our times a little
straightened up. He was too young to go into the war.
Mm-hmm.
and to join up. He tried, but he was too young. He wouldn't, and they wouldn't take him. But you know, it was before the war, and he went down, and he was. It was during the summer, and there was. Is this record? Oh, I won't say no. But anyway, it was quite an adventure for him. First time he'd ever been to New York, and he was quite taken with it. But he said, "I never want to go back."
So just 16, and he was driving this big truck back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why would he go to New York for the truck? Do you know?
His father evidently had found this truck that he was interested in, so he wanted Bob to go down and get it. Mother said no, but Dad said yes, so Bob went.
And he came back without mishap, bringing the truck back.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's a few states that he went through. He said really given a good run over, you know, because they were wondering why he was bringing this big truck back. But anyway, he said it wasn't too bad. There was only just a couple of states where they kind of did a lot of questioning, but other than that, he was fine.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not sure if I clarified this because lots of names floating around here. Mm-hmm. So your husband's father was Leslie.
Right.
And Leslie was the superintendent of one of the grain elevators?
Of Searle.
Of Searle. Oh, okay. Got that straightened out. So then when we do our historical research, you know, look at all the documents, and we can put all these names together with your husband. So do you have anything more to add about the history of the company once the truck arrived?
Not really, because you know, like Bob never really went into it in any detail to me after we were married, so it made it, you know, he just his main purpose was making sure all the trucks were in and they did their job.
Mixing concrete.
So that one truck grew to how many over time, do you know?
We had about 16 there.
Yeah. Yeah. That many anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there was about 16 trucks that went in. And he had a lot of porta plants, you know. He had the first porta plant here, and he had those sent out to, we'd sent a porta plant out to Nipigon, Marathon, Kenora, and up north, and I know there was...
He even sold one to Newfoundland.
Hmm?
Remember the one they took to Newfoundland?
Newfoundland?
Yeah.
Oh, did he?
I took it down to Quebec.
Oh,
Montreal, and took it down to the docks, and they loaded it on the ship.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So what is a porta plant?
Porta plant is, you can probably explain it.
It's a portable plant on wheels that they move around.
Makes concrete.
Has a hopper on it, conveyor belt. You fill the hopper and it mixes.
Yeah, it makes concrete.
Yeah.
Concrete.
How big would something like that be? Just sort of, if we looked at the size of a porta potty, how many?
You could probably mix about 3 yards at a time, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So did he construct these here?
No, I don't know where he got it from.
No, he would buy them, and he bought the first one, and from any concrete that the concrete plants were here, he bought the first one, and then because he had so many calls for concrete out of town, and it would be far too costly to haul, say, you know, even to Kenora, loads of concrete. So that's when I think with Kenora was
actually what there was it was just a hopper on.
Yeah.
We used in a conveyor belt,
mm-hmm.
and they would put that gravel into the truck mixer and mix it in the truck.
And the cement and that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because his trucks would haul the material, but they would make the concrete in the hopper plant, like in the hopper, and then the concrete trucks would take and disperse them to the wherever they had to go, like when they were doing all the mines in Marathon. And they did all the, they had the contract for pouring all the mines up there. That's why they had it in Terrace Bay. He had a plant in Terrace Bay too, the Port of Plant in Terrace, because Greg was there. And then in Marathon when Greg was managing it. Yeah. And so, as I said, he whenever they were called on to do a big job, they would bid on it. And if they got it, then what they would do is send a porter plant. And when the porter plant would go up, well, then they would get drivers that, and they used to stay there. Whoever it was, they would stay right there.
Yeah.
The drivers and the fellas that did the mixing and what have you. Mm-hmm.
What was the history of the company once your husband started it up? Did it stay in the family for a while?
Well, it was always in the family, but when Perma Concrete came in with him, they retained the name of, but they were getting all the concrete in that. I mean
the permanent. They didn't come in until they went to Fort William Road.
Fort William Road.
Yeah.
You see, they had it on Gore Street. Their plant was originally on Gore Street, and it wasn't until he went over, and he had such a demand for business, and out of town, so much demand, and the elevators and Richardson's elevator, and then when the one fell into the lake, well, he had that one to do too, you know. And so anyway, then Permanent Concrete came in, and they went in with him on that. But it wasn't until he took over, until they had this large plant built at Intercity. And but he just couldn't keep up with it. So Permanent Concrete came in, and they worked together. And right to the end, didn't they?
Until Lafarge came.
Lafarge, yes. And then when Lafarge came in at the very end there, like that's when Bob retired.
Lafarge took over the company then,
mm-hmm.
bought it from?
From Permanent then.
From Permanent.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob was managing it all the way along until
mm-hmm.
Lafarge
yes.
took over.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any competitors in Thunder Bay at the time?
North Shore. There was North Shore and Pitla. That's only two, wasn't it? North Shore
yeah.
and Pitla.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, there was just the two.
And was Irwin the largest, would you say?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, by far. Mm-hmm.
So they were able to take on the major projects.
Oh, yes, mm-hmm. Like the Great Lakes, the mill out there.
Yeah.
And you did all that, and you did the addition when they put that new part on. And I know people even phoned and wanted him very badly to do a job, and he said no. He said he just couldn't do it, and he said, well, he had gotten a phone call from a Winnipeg firm that Bob did a job for them, and he said, if you have to have anything done, don't you dare get anybody else but Irwin's, because he said that concrete has stood up without a crack or a flaw in it for umpteen years. And they couldn't get over it. So, but he said no. He said because he had to go to, I think it was a Mr. Anderson to get the material. And so Bob said, well, he said, I can't advise you which way to go. But he said, I think I'd make some more inquiries. Because he was very, very fussy about his gravel. And remember,
yeah.
Oh, I know, I tramped more gravel pits with him and trying to get the right sources, and he was always, and then when I went back to university and took a course in forestry, he was quite upset.
Some of the elevators, they got the gravel from the lake shore.
Yes, oh, that was the best stuff.
Yeah,
they could.
Hogan's,
hmm?
And they dumped it on at Hogan's gravel plant on the Cam River there.
Oh.
And then they truck it over to Irwin's plant.
Mm. Yeah, well, they used to. Oh.
They were still doing that when I started there.
Is that right,
yeah.
eh?
So, where on the lakeshore were they getting this gravel from?
Yeah, down east. towards Nipigon.
Yeah, that was the best gravel they ever got.
They just dig it right out of the bottom of the lake.
It was all clean. It was clean gravel. What are you doing?
How did your husband build his expertise in concrete? Like, how did he get to be so good at it?
I often wondered about that, because he was so interested in everything that was going on in concrete, and I don't know, he never did say, but I think his father was behind him on that. But where he really obtained all his knowledge from, I never did find out.
Ed Schilling, he was pretty...
Who was that?
Ed Schilling, the batchman.
Oh.
That's the first batchman Bob had.
Oh.
And he
knew about it, eh?
He knew quite a bit about it.
Oh, it was his batchman then he probably got all this knowledge from.
Yeah.
Ed Schilling, did you say?
Ed Schilling, yeah.
And he was a Thunder Bay person?
Yeah.
So I guess before the time that your husband started up Irwin mm-hmm. Concrete, somebody must have been doing that ahead of time. For the elevators.
I think wasn't one of the Zanetti's mixed up in it?
Oh, Zanetti's.
Yeah.
They were making
concrete
then.
Yeah, but not on a big scale.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I really don't have that much knowledge of it, because Bob never really spoke to me much about it. He, as I said, all he ever spoke about was whether the drivers had gotten in or not.
Making sure that everything occurred as it was supposed to,
mm-hmm.
when it was supposed to.
Right. Especially those calls that come in the middle of the night when the ships were coming in with a load of concrete or something like that. We'd get this phone call. Well, I'll be on at 3 in the morning. So Bob said, well, be sure and wake me up at 3. And I thought, wait, that's the middle of the night for me. But anyway, because he had to be over to the ship, over to the dock to make sure that everything was unloaded.
At Kiefer Terminal.
Mm-hmm.
Or I guess once Kiefer Terminal was there.
No, it wasn't Kiefer Terminal. Where did they do they?
They used to unload cement right down the Cam River.
Yes.
Where they have them rowing boats there.
So near Ogilvie Elevator then.
Yeah. That's where Jack Irwin had the St. Lawrence.
Oh, the St. Lawrence. Yes, he had the St. Lawrence there. That was between the rowing club and Ogilvie's.
What was the St. Lawrence?
Cement.
And another Irwin.
Yeah, that was John Irwin's son that ran this elevator, and that was his son that went into that business.
So he was the one who brought in the cement?
Yeah, Inland brought the cement in, didn't they?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's a lot of mix.
Okay, so let's go back to John Irwin then.
Mm-hmm.
And John Irwin was one of the, would have been your husband's uncle?
Yes.
And then his son was?
Jack Irwin.
And he was involved in?
The hauling the cement in. And that was along the Cam River between the rowing club and that was inland cement.
And so the cement, that was the supplier for your husband's cement
at that time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, a real family.
Oh, it was. It was all kind of interlocked. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It really was.
Any other little tentacles there that you recall?
No, all I know is a couple of fellas that were working for Jack Irwin when they came back from the war. The fellas that carried them through. They had to let them go because they gave all the fellas back their jobs when they came back. And so this one fellow was a little upset because Alan Sutherland came back. And he didn't want his job, but John Irwin says, yes, this was your job before you went overseas, so he married Ruth Irwin.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it was all kind of interlocked pretty well through, except for the big ones and the waterfront. There's nothing very much. They didn't have anything to do with any of those, did they? Irwin's had nothing to do with the ones at Intercity. I don't think they had anything to do with any of those elevators. No.
I'm not sure.
No. No, because there was SAS, Pool 7. No, none of those. It was just the ones in the Westford area, it seemed, that Searles and
Cargill.
He rebuilt Richardson, the one that fell down.
Oh, yes. Yeah. He rebuilt, added to Richardson's. He's added to several of them. He added to the malt plant, too, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, he added to the malt plant. Because they needed more storage. Richardson's, they needed more storage, and he did that one. And then there was the one opposite Kiefer. Which one is that right opposite Kiefer? You know, the
P&H.
P&H, yes. Well, in P&H, because the boats used to come in there and unload a lot of stuff for him, too. And because just as you come along, there was all those sand piles along there. And I know he had work there to do too. And then the one that fell in the river, fell in the lake, that explosion, he had all that construction. In fact, what he used to do, like some so often when they were pouring, they would have to do, constant pouring, you know.
Oh, yeah, that's when they poured the tanks.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he would take his boat over. He had a 38-foot cruiser. He'd bring it over and tie it along the dock, and he would sleep on it to make sure that, you know, the fellas kept going, because, you see, if you ever stopped, it would leave a crack, and so it had to be a continuous pour. What did they call that continuous pour?
Slip form?
Slip form. Slip forming, yes. And he said, no, he said, when they were doing slip forming, even when they did the stack at the mouth of the Mission River, he said...
For the hydro plant, yeah.
You were on that too, weren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
For the hydro plant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I know they were all quite pleased when they finally were able to accommodate all the grain and that was coming down from the west. And especially during wartime when the demand was so great, because they had no place. That's why they built all these storage bins. But they did very well.
So your husband's career ended with the sale, and that was 19...
No, he retired.
Okay.
And he'd already taken, as Lafarge had already taken over.
Okay.
And
so remind me again, I think you have already said what date he retired, what year, or approximately?
It was around
80.
I retired in 73, and he retired shortly after, I think.
73.
If I remember right.
Yeah, I think he retired in the 80s. Didn't he retire in the 80s?
You retired later than 73.
Later than 73?
Lived at the lake, and that was in about 83.
Oh, maybe it was
80. Maybe more, yeah.
Seemed to me he retired.
It's not that important. The reason I was asking was as I was just trying to get an idea of when that was.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And I've been asked that so many times, and when I moved here, it's okay. I had that in my mind, and then seniors kicking in again.
You have nothing to apologize for. Because did he ever talk to you about how he felt once the grain industry started to sort of let up in Thunder Bay?
Yes, quite often he would speak to me, we would talk about, he said, this is, it's really sad, he always used the word sad. It's so sad to see this going down. It's going downhill. And and then he had some friend that his mother knew. It was a friend of his mother's, really, that came from the West when they had the Bad Depression out there where they were moving here to get jobs. And he used to tell them about the sad things that happened in regards to the grain out there. And he said, you know, he said, that ever happened, he said, it's going to kill Canada. Because he said, I just hate to see the grain sliding the way it's going. And, you know, he just used to, it was very upset to see the way things were going.
You know, when I first started to go downhill, mm-hmm. when he opened that one at Prince Rupert, he built an elevator
Prince Rupert.
There. Yeah.
Yeah,
and
that's when she's,
the grain to
they were going across the other side, yes.
Yeah.
When Prince Rupert, when they opened up the elevators up there, and then the Churchill, I know he was always quite concerned about the one in Churchill. And I said, well, it's so seasonal there, but now that you never know what's going to happen, because it'd be much shorter than just to dig up there and then the ship from there, instead of going all the way through the lakes and the canals and what they're charging to go through all the canals and what have you, and the Welland and the Sioux. And
so with global warming,
yes,
making it
harder,
more desirable to ship out of
Churchill.
Actually, being more able to ship out of Churchill.
Oh yes, mm-hmm. Yes, it will be. So, it's, as I said, it's the whole world. It just seems to be changing and everything. You know, the growth of the, I know the boats out here, like I'm very involved with the Mission to Seafarers, and out here we've got we had two ships laying out there for so long, but they were waiting for canola, the grains and that. There was none coming through. And so they sat out there for 3 or 4 days. And they had to, because, I mean, if they anchor, they don't have to pay fees for docking fees. So they lay it out there. So they used to get some of the people with small boats go out and bring them in periodically, because they'd come onto the Mission to Seafarers and phone, and we'd give them coffee. And if it's a foreign ship, we used to give them clothes to keep them warm, because they came in from the islands. They'd come in with short sleeves and no gloves or anything. So we'd bring them in, and the fellows would bring them in, and we would make sure, took them in, make sure they had warm jackets, sweaters. And one fellow came in, he didn't have a toque or anything, he had short hair, so he saw one, he put it on his head, and he says, oh, that good, you know, and they couldn't speak English, half them. So he saw another one, he put it on top, and you know, so, and I said, you know, take them, because I said, you know, and there's always one interpreter that comes along. And so I told him, I said, well, take two of them and give it to someone on board the boat. So he took both of them. And one day it was a Russian ship was in, and it was so cute. They had quite a long wait too. And so I said, well, bring them in and we'll fit them up with food and what have you. So they came in. And he saw a little boy's jacket there. And he looked at the little jacket, and he looked at it. And so I said, you know, for him to take it. And he said, yes. So he took it, and he says, my boy. Aww. He was going to take it back to Russia for his little boy.
You know, we had talked about this, the mm-hmm. Mission to Seafarers, and we have set up an interview with the fellow.
Did you have one
fellow
with them?
I don't think it's been conducted yet, but mm-hmm. Ernie Epp is going to do that, because he knows the mm-hmm. pastor that you had mentioned.
Oh,
but I think, you know, mm-hmm. I think it would still be nice to interview you, but I'd mm-hmm. like to continue on mm-hmm. and...
I'm sorry.
and have Mr. Randall talk about when he...
She knows more.
Well, no, because what we want, you see, we also want to know the everyday work that was done on to get these jobs done. So just tell us a little bit about the work that you did for Irwin Concrete.
Well, I poured on pretty near every job, every big job. elevators, and the hydro plant was the biggest ones, mm-hmm. as far as big pours in the day. When we poured on, first started pouring for the elevators, they'd have to drive piling first, Thunder Bay Harbor drive the piling, and then I think Barnum McQueen would come put the steel bars in, foreman put the steel bars in, and then Bob would come along and pour the concrete.
So you had mentioned, I think before we even started, or at the beginning of the interview, about the pilings. What do you know about the pilings that they used for the elevators?
When I was a kid, my dad was taking piling out for elevators, wood piling.
He was taking it out or putting it in, or cutting it?
Cutting it in the bush. And he had a 40-foot boat that he would cut him in the bush. We lived on the lake shore at Sturgeon Bay. And he would cut the piling, bring them down and put them in the water, tie them all together and tow them into Thunder Bay. He actually towed a bunch in for a surge elevator.
Uh-huh.
And then the tug, I think that's where he maybe tied them all up there, then a tug would come along and tow them to whatever elevator they need them at.
So let's go back to your family then. You said that your dad was living at Sturgeon Bay.
Yeah.
So that's out towards the border.
Yeah.
How? What's the history of your family? How did they end up in that area?
Well, my dad come from Wyarton. His parents come from England, and my dad started in Wyarton. You know what that is?
Is that the Wyarton Willie?
Yeah,
town?
Yeah.
So where exactly is that? It's in southern Ontario, is it?
Yeah. It's around the Georgian Bay area.
And what brought him to the Thunder Bay area, do you know?
Ben Renshaw was a friend of his, and I think they met down there. They all come from, the parents come from the old country, and they met down there. Ben Renshaw had a lumber business on the Cloud River. That's how my dad got started in the bush, I guess.
So would that, Mr. Renshaw is the name that you mentioned?
Yeah.
Yes. So did he send logs down the Cloud River then into the bay?
Well, they used to cut timber in that Cloud Bay area. Eh? He cut the big pine, white pine, for lumber. He had a sawmill set up on the riverbank.
And then there was they would have a log boom that they would create to...
You know, they tried to haul them all in from the, on the ground. Eh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And once they got them in the water, you were talking about your dad.
That's my dad, yeah. He got them, most of the timber from Sturgeon Bay area and outside of Sturgeon Bay in the bush, wherever you could find them in them days. And he took the spruce and jack pine. They took mostly for piling, but he took booms out too. That was a big boom logs, 20 feet long, and it was some of them 4 feet on the one end.
So were you involved with helping your dad?
I was a little too young.
Yeah. So do you know when he would have been doing this cutting? The Searle elevator, I'm just trying to think of when it was when it was being built, if he was building or cutting the piles
no,
for that.
No, he just used to tie the... He had a 40-foot boat that he towed them in with, and he tied the piling up there. Some was used at the Searle elevator, but I think that was after it was built.
Yes, they did.
Used for, I guess, for docks and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've just seen some pictures of the Searle elevator where they did an addition, and
I
saw some pictures of the pilings going in.
Bob would be doing that.
Yeah. Quite an amazing amount of timber went into those the foundations for those elevators.
Yeah, it took a lot. A lot of it used to haul into Thunder Bay Harbor, because they used to drive them, Thunder Bay Harbor.
And how did you get involved in driving truck, I guess? Was that your first job with Irwin's?
No, that is my... I drove for my dad. When I got out of school, I was 15 when I finished school, and I went driving for him. He rode with me a year till I could get my license, and then I took over driving.
Because even you needed to be 16 then, too, to get your license.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And why did you move on from your dad to Irwin's?
Well, my dad died in 56.
Oh. Yeah.
So I had a chance to get on there, so I took it.
What was a day on the job like when you first started? Do you remember?
Well, I used to work about 10, 12 hours hauling for Great Lakes Mill. And then we'd unload cement till 9 o'clock at night. I'd bag cement out of cars and dump it on a conveyor, put it up to the top of the plant.
So was that physical labor then, that lifting the sacks? Do you remember how much they weighed?
100 pounds, I think.
100 pounds in those days, I think.
Yeah, 100-pound bags, I remember that.
I used to have a sore back every morning. You know?
Oh, I imagine.
Yeah.
You must have been in great physical shape.
Got it done anyway.
Mm. What, the company still at the Gore Street plant when you were doing this?
Yeah.
So what did that plant setup look like?
Well, it was, used to have the lunchroom and everything down on the bottom, and the garage on one side of it, and then the conveyor would come up the back, bring the cement up the back, put it up in a big bin up above. And that's where they get the cement from, concrete from the next day.
And as a truck driver, what did you have to do? So when you showed up for a job?
Fill the water tank. And when you showed up in the morning, even, well, you'd check the oil and everything and make sure everything was working. Get the mixer started up, and the mixer had its own motor in them days.
And how does that differ from now? The mixers don't have their own motors?
No, it's all hydraulic, if air or oil.
The water, was that just from the city water supply, or did they?
Yeah.
And how would you know how to mix it?
How'd you know
the recipe?
Well, the mixer, the batch man got it all, everything mixed, ready to mix. And
pretty well.
And if you had to have a job on the water on the job, you just put some in. You had a water tank on the mixer, so you just add whatever you figured you needed.
Different jobs had different designs, though, concrete designs, didn't they?
Oh, yeah.
They would state what design they wanted in their concrete. So,
wanted a 3,000 pound, you had to put so many bags in, or 2,000, you put less bags. But the batch man done all that. It was all weighed out.
And so then you were just given the ingredients and told to... put them together.
Yeah, make sure you don't make it too wet.
Not too wet.
Yeah.
No, I understand that really has an impact on the strength of the concrete.
They usually want it around a 3-inch slump. I mean, it would move good and a lot easier to work with.
Now, talk about a 3-inch slump. What does that mean to those of us who don't know anything about slumps?
Well, they put it in a cylinder about that high, that big around the bottom, and that big around the top.
So almost like a cone.
Yeah, a cone, yeah. And then they fill that with concrete, and the inspector done that. And then he would pull the cone up, and if it fell down too much, he'd measure from the top. They wanted 3-inch, it was over 3-inch, well, they didn't like that.
Ah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, he just measured, lay his bar on the top with a cone and measure from there up to the cone.
And what would happen if it did slump too much?
Well, they usually took it out. I mean, it wouldn't be that much out of line. If it's really too wet, they'd send you back. Plant.
And then what would happen back at the plant? So they'd send you back to the plant with a full truck of...
Yeah, then you'd have to put more cement in it and aggregate.
So what goes into, what would go into a load that you took out to an elevator? You'd have the water.
Yeah, you'd have the water and air entrainment, they called it. That's to, I don't know, put air into the concrete.
And then the aggregate was this?
Cement and sand and the aggregate was thrown in.
Did you have to go as a truck driver? Were you also responsible for going to the, I don't know if it was the gravel pits to pick up the?
No.
No, he used to, no, Bob used to have Mr. McConnell and the people that would...
Lempiella, he used to get it hauled in from Lempiella sand.
Mm-hmm.
He'd haul it in.
Yeah, they had several pits around that they could draw from, like, you know, and then they'd always have drivers haul it in for them.
And all of this would just be stored in the yard on
mm-hmm.
Gore Street and you'd
mm-hmm.
pull together what you needed for a job.
There's slack, there's two of us drivers would take the dump trucks in the winter time and haul in.
Winter was a slow time.
Mm.
Yeah.
So keep them. Bob used to love to keep his men on all year, you know, and as much as he could. So that's when they used to do a lot of hauling.
Yeah.
In the winter time.
Yeah.
Do you mind if we take a little pause now? At lunchtime.
Oh,
so.
I see.
Okay, we're going, ready?
Yeah, I'm gonna eat lunch.
Yeah. Well, before we stopped, we were talking about the life of a cement truck driver, and you had commented on, you know, having learned to drive with hauling logs. So that was a pretty challenging task as well.
Piling, they call them.
So.
Good.
What kind of truck did you drive when you first started driving cement? Like, what make was it? Was it the one that Mrs. Irwin talked about?
No, it was a KB8, if you know it, the old International.
Tell me about them, because there'll be people listening to this who'll wonder, who will be interested in
the
equipment.
The one I had was in pretty good shape.
That wasn't the one that was brought up from...
No.
New York.
Oh,
No. I think that went long. That was on Gore Street. I don't think that lasted too long.
They still had one of them there when I started, but
mm-hmm.
I don't know if they used it or not. I don't think so.
So what kind of capacity and so on was
well,
that kind
it
of
had, you could get eight yards in it. I think it was a 5-yard mixer, but you got 8 in it sometimes.
And that was the kind that had its own engine or motor for the...
Yeah, yeah. You used to have a motor sitting between the cab and the... It was right on the mixer of the little motor, little Chrysler motor. You'd have to get that running to turn the... so you could turn the drum in.
So tell us about the maintenance work that you had to do as as a truck driver, it wasn't just you sat in behind
just,
and...
You just had to keep the grease, enough grease on it. I think the mechanic used to change the oil. That's all he had to do, keep it clean. I backed the drum one time when I didn't have much to do. Make it shine a little bit. There wasn't much you had to do, really.
So you took pride in the look of the equipment as well?
Yeah.
How long would one of those trucks last? Was it years, or was it by mileage, sort of, that?
Mostly by mileage, I think. But, well, if you looked after them, they'd last quite a while.
What would be a good mileage to get out of a truck before you retired it?
You could get maybe 300,000. Sometimes you went in pretty rough places, eh?
Mm-hmm.
We used to haul for a pipeline. I was pulling a mixer trailer at that time and hauling in close to Nipping. You go way back in the bush when they was putting pipeline, the gas pipeline through there. And they'd hook a bulldozer on you and you had to go where a beam at. There was mud up to the running boards on the mixer. And really, I wouldn't have put my truck in there, but that's where you had to go.
Hmm. Did you ever have any close calls driving the cement trucks?
Oh, yeah. Quite a few.
Is there one that stands out in your mind?
Well, there was one time I was going to Red Rock in the wintertime, and the road was slippery. Coming down the hill to a bridge, and on the other side, a school bus turned in front of me, and he turned at pace to turn around there, but I didn't know he was going to pull out in front of me, so I had to try and get it stopped. But I managed to get it slowed down enough. He got off the road, and I went by.
Oh.
I wouldn't have wanted to hit that. Kids in it.
No, oh, frightening.
It would have been an awful mess. Well, you get a few close calls when you're going all the time, eh? Especially hauling around town.
And you worked for how many years doing this? It was
37.
37, that's
yeah.
A good long career.
Yeah. I liked it. It's a good job.
What did you like about it?
Well, one thing, you was home all the time. But I used to like getting out on the highway too. But when I got on a trailer mixer, you could, if you wanted, they sent me to Montreal one time. And you'd unhook off the mixer and hook onto a float.
What would you be doing in Montreal?
One time I took a portable plant down there. And I come back to Brockville, that's where the head office was. And then they sent me back to Montreal to get a load of steel and bring back to Brockville. That's what I was doing down there. But quite often we haul go out west and haul concrete.
So how far west, just to the Ontario border, or you went beyond that too?
Just stop and think. Well, I used to move stuff around for the pipeline too, like the forms. So it was between Thunder Bay and Edmonton at that time. Wherever they needed the forms, I used to take them. It was good. I used to like getting out on the highway once in a while.
Yeah. But the elevator jobs would have kept you busy in town here. What was the biggest elevator job that you worked on, do you recall?
One that fell in the lake there, that was about the biggest one, I guess.
That was the one by Current River?
Yeah.
What was involved there?
You had to clean all the grain out of the lake, and what concrete was it there, take it all out and haul it out to the gravel pit,
a mess.
Abandoned gravel pit.
Where was the Bannon gravel pit?
Abandoned one.
Abandoned one. Yeah. Do you remember where it was? I have a special interest in knowing where these concrete ended up.
Mm-hmm.
That was Onion Lake Road, I think. Up in there.
How did you actually get the concrete and the grain out of the lake?
Well, they used the drag lines. If they couldn't reach it with the bucket, they'd have to use a drag line with the bucket on. Pulled it out and loaded in the dump truck.
When those bins fell in, did they actually smash up, or did they sort of fall in as big,
well,
intact
silos? It'd be the
silos.
Whole thing that went in. I guess it broke up as it hit the water and stuff. Some of them waved it right over to the shipyards. So,
and then did they re-pour the silos?
Oh yeah, they had to drive more piling and pour the foundation. They figured how come it fell down was the ships coming in, and when they turned the compressors to stop, propellers over the years, well, it washed the dirt out from between the piling and stuff. That's what they figured happened.
Do you remember where the pilings were coming from for that job then? Were they still coming from?
Well, probably some of them could have been wooden piling, but I think they used to use steel piling in the later years.
Ah.
Yeah.
Great.
So Thunder Bay Harbor done all that.
I think earlier on in the interview you were talking about what it was like to construct, be involved in constructing an elevator, but I don't know that we finished, because you were talking about there was the pilings, and then a company came in and did
steel.
The and then
steel bars and everything,
the rebar,
but they had to put forms around the outside.
Mm-hmm.
I think Barnum McQueen done most of that work,
and then you would be involved in
pouring the concrete, yeah. Some pours would be maybe 400 yards. In them days, they put runways down and you dumped into a buggy, and the men pushed it till you got filled up. Must have poured them in sections, maybe 400 a day, 400 yards, but they'd wheel it off.
So this was in the early days when you started then? In the 60s, probably,
well,
that they were wheeling it?
It'd be in the 60s, and I think they still wheel some in the 70s even, before
and
they got pumps. It was pretty late before they got the pumps.
Ah.
But then you couldn't get anybody to push a wheelbarrow after that.
They'd found the easy life.
I took a load to Red Rock Mill one time, and there's about 10 guys standing around there in the foreman room waiting for me, but the pump was supposed to come, and the pump broke down. So I said to all young guys, they big and strong, I said, you better grab a wheelbarrow and start wheeling. What? He says, we don't push a wheelbarrow this day and age. That had to be about 40 years ago, I guess.
So how did the job get done?
Well, the foreman, he was an older man, and he grabbed a wheelbarrow and started wheeling. So I guess a shame something. Yeah, nice old guy.
Did everything always go as planned on these pours for the elevators, or were there ever any problems that you remember?
They went pretty steady as far as I can remember. There's, two 12-hour shifts. You couldn't go real fast because they'd put it in that hoist bucket I told you about.
Mm-hmm.
They would hoist it up. It wouldn't be too high in the start, but as you went up, it got higher. So they didn't want to pour it too fast, because when they jack the forms up so the concrete would move, right? So.
Mm.
But they used to take it up there, dump it in a hopper on the wherever the level was, dump it on the in a hopper, and then they wheeled all the way around the tank with wheelbarrows, buggies. So then they'd have to, I guess they could be high enough to dump it into the form. Eh?
So these forms would go right up to the top, so they eventually they'd be hauling those buckets.
Well, they keep jacking the forms up. They pour till they got full, and then they'd have to jack them.
And how was that jacking done?
I don't know. They had some kind of hydraulic jacks there. I don't know how. I never seen how they worked.
Was there just one person operating that, or?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
More than likely had it by worked by air or oil. I'm not sure. But they fill the form and then they'd have to jack it up. But they couldn't go too fast. So I don't know if they did two tanks at the same time. It could have been, because then by the time they got the next one full, the first one would be dry enough to lift up. Because they used to go steady with them. And the form actually would only be maybe 4 feet high, something like that.
And they went up over 100 feet when they were finished. So that was a long...
120 feet, I think, the elevators was, yeah.
Mm. That rings a bell.
And then the one tank, I think the one tank, the B boat on the slab, the B boat, six tanks, maybe six or eight.
Yeah.
And I think they'd have two side by side, which is pretty big tanks, maybe each one be 50 feet across.
The silos?
Each tank.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Pretty big, anyway.
How thick were the foundations, the slab, do you recall?
Oh, about 4 feet, anyway. Mm. Yeah.
Hmm. So you said you had a 12-hour shift.
Yeah.
How many loads could you haul over that time period? Obviously, it would depend on how far away the elevator was, but let's say something within 15, 20-minute drive.
I'm not just sure. But you have more than one truck, so I mean, maybe three trucks hauling, something like that. You'd probably haul maybe 10 loads. Mm. I'm not sure. I can't remember.
Did the size of the trucks change over the time that you were...
The size?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The last one I retired, I got all 12 yards in that truck.
And I think you said the first one was 4, but you could get 6 in it. Was that what you said?
Sometimes.
Anything else change in the trucks, or were they pretty much the same?
Oh, yeah. They get better riding all the time. Seats get better. First seat, like sitting on that table. But they got better in the end. Hydraulic seats and stuff.
They
like
had a lot of Max trucks at one time, didn't they, not?
Pardon?
A lot of Max trucks.
Max, towards the end, yeah. The last one I drove was a Mac.
Max and International.
He was nice. Easy shifting, they call it. Maxidine shifting.
Mm. Did you have a favorite truck?
Little International on the trailer was my favorite.
Did you get to drive the same truck all the time, or was it whatever truck was available? Or was you assigned a truck?
I drove the same one all the time.
So did you name them?
Well, I didn't have a special name.
Oh, Bucky.
I thought guys always named their trucks.
Remember Buster? He was driving a Max truck, and he says, in order to get that to go faster, he said, I used to tie a wiener out in front of the picture.
Do you have anything to ask Ian? I'm not a really technical person when it comes to trucks. So.
No. Well, they used to have a lot of...
I was going to tell you about hauling concrete to the Nipigon Bridge. It's on a straight truck, and they haul 6 yards. And about 6 days in a row, I took a load down, and the guy testing it wouldn't... His machine was haywire, but he figured it wasn't. So he tested, and the air wasn't right. I think I dumped about 3 or 4 loads in the gravel pit. I said, well, if you test that meter, maybe it's haywire. So he finally did test it, and it was haywire. So he had to pay for all that concrete, eh? 6 yards, just take it there and dump it.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of wasteful.
Which reminds me, I'm thinking of different things about concrete, and when you were talking about the concrete being carried up the forms to build the bins, all the way up, did they also have to do the vibration then? Every time they poured in the concrete, did they have to vibrate it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so that would also delay things a bit, like as far as making it slower to... unload your load and...
It wouldn't slow them down, but it could only go so fast anyway, so... I forget how far they go in a shift. I think about 8 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Who would be doing the concrete work itself? Like the actual...
The Carraza. You mean the work?
Mm-hmm.
Hard
mm-hmm.
work. Carraza. His men, eh?
Are they still in business?
No. Well, Vi's still there. In fact, I was talking to her last night, and she's not doing it. But Reno, her husband, was in charge. And then when Reno passed away, Mario took over his relative. But he didn't keep it going very well.
He took over right at the end of it.
Yeah, that's for sure. Just running around. But anyway, no, they don't. They don't operate at all anymore.
No.
But Reno was very, very good.
Hey, pardon?
Reno was very, very good.
Reno,
he was such a conscientious man.
So was that the only company involved, as far as you know, in the actual sort of placement of it? And
no, there was other men.
Yeah, there was a couple other, but that's the only one that Bob really, like, he was a perfectionist. Put it that way. He was a real perfectionist, and it didn't matter whether you're a friend or not a friend. If you did the job the way I want, perfect, then you've got it. And that's the way he was with Reno, and that's how we got to know Reno, too.
Yeah. So they worked well together?
Oh, very well. Mm-hmm. Yes, very well. And if there's anything that Bob wasn't pleased about, he would speak to Reno, and Reno would have it just like that. And the other way around, if he didn't care, the concrete wasn't exactly what Reno wanted for that job, he'd speak to Bob and, you know, straightened out immediately. And they worked so well, and that's why I think they got so many jobs. They were just number one all over, because they were just highly recommended, because the two of them worked so well together.
Yeah.
Was there ever any repair work done on the elevators that required... concrete that you recall, besides the big one with the...
It's always...
with the bins falling into the lake.
There's always something to do. And we used to take it over a couple of roads there, maybe once in a while.
It was
just patchwork, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with the ships, you know what I mean, coming and going all the time, they really would loosen the sand and that, and it would... suction out, and then first thing you know, you'd get cracks or you'd have splits and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And they'd have to go over and redo the thing, you know, and do it all. If fix it up so that there would be no further damage. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that place that fell in was never ever checked that
no,
much.
No.
No, they just kind of just ran on their good luck and gave out.
So are there any other changes that occurred in your job over the 37 years you were there that...
Not too much, I don't think. I haven't been there now for about 30 years, so...
Mm-hmm. That's hard to believe, eh?
Yes.
That the 80s would be 30 years.
Mm-hmm. It's got to be about 30 years since I've been there.
No.
No?
No, not that long. Because you retired, when you retired, we moved to the lake. We were there 10 years, and we've been in town now 5 years. That's only 15 years.
Right?
15 years?
Seems longer.
Seems longer.
It's nice to have a wife to keep you on line.
Yeah.
When I retired, if I could have, if I we was building a house in that time, if I wasn't working at the house, I'd have went back to work.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I did come in a couple of times. They mm-hmm. called me in.
Yeah.
And that was all.
Yeah, they needed your experience.
It took about a year to get away from it.
Well, Bob always considered Keith, we always called him Buck, he's one of his number one driver. And if someone ever complained about something, I've heard him say, never mind, I'll have Buck delivered to you, because he knew that Buck would look after things.
Yeah. What makes a number one driver?
Courteous to driver, to the customers, very good, on time, and they always appreciated your friendliness. They always thought he's so friendly, he's so polite, and they really, really liked him. And Bob was always so pleased when there was ever a complaint come in, you know, because some of them, you know, the newer ones, they weren't really that experienced. And it's hard to get a concrete driver anyway, you know, I mean, that knows the concrete, and just to put them out on a job, even with a driver, I mean, when they're on their own, they kind of get a little carried away sometimes, you know, and he had that with a couple of young ones. And so he, never mind, he says, I'll sound out my number one man.
He would also help the people if they were sure to help.
He would get out,
take the concrete off his truck.
He'd get out and level it, and
once in a while.
No, he'd get out more and help them.
Job. If it's on a slow job, I'd push a wheelbarrow.
Yeah, I know. That's what Bob was saying. Like, you know, I know there was an older man phoned one time, and he was very upset because he couldn't get anyone. He had, I guess, someone, but that knew nothing about it, and you went out on that job, and he phoned. And he said, wanted to know, you know, all about you. And so Bob gave you a very, very good recommendation. And he said that he even came out of his truck and helped me. And I thought, well, that's nice to hear. Bob was so thrilled about that. But, you know, to get drivers that'll do that now, well, here's your load. Make the best of it.
Well, I think... That is my list of questions, unless you have something, Ian, to add or ask.
I'm really interested in your mission to seafarers.
Oh.
Can you tell us how you got involved in that?
Well, actually, and there was, I'm a lieutenant commander, retired from the Navy, you see. And so what happened, our minister at the church, he was Army, and I had arranged for the 11th of November parade at the church, and got everything all ready. So he said, I want you over for the mission. And I said, for what? Where am I going? Africa? And he said, no. He said, we have our mission over here, and he said, we need helpers. And I said, well, sure. I said, I'll go and give you a hand. So anyway, I went over, and I was introduced to some of the fellows coming in on their ships, and so they, as a rule, and I none of them spoke English. And so I said, I don't know how to, what do? You know, and they said, do the best you can. Of course, I taught school, so, you know, I was a retired school teacher. So anyway, I said, okay, fine. I said, do the best we can. So anyway, they came in, and they would be cold because we have a van that goes and picks them up. And we hear from Sandy Henderson which ships are coming in. He's in the port, one of the port authorities. And he says, such and such boat will be in, and this one's from the Philippines, or this one's from Sweden, or whatever. So they would come in, and they would get in touch with us and tell us how many wanted to come ashore, or if there's anyone coming ashore. So fine. We send our van over, pick them up, bring them to the center, and would you like a cup of coffee? There's some cookies, or we'll make you something to eat. And so anyway, they would sit down, they'd have a cup of coffee, and first of all, can we phone? So we said yes. So we had time watches, and we had to, when they went in to phone, and we'd get the number for them. They'd give us a number, we'd get the number for them to make sure they got a hold of the party, because some of those people over there, they don't have phones. So they have to, you phone this number, they have to run a couple of miles or a mile or so down the road to get the person to get up. And of course, the time difference would be about 3 o'clock in the morning, their time, in the midnight, middle of the night, I should say. And they would have to bring them back to the phone. So they would, and they said, well, it'll take you how long to bring them and so. So anyway, they would phone back. And so they'd sit there, and then we'd time them. And when they got off the phone, they would pay us, or they could buy cards, and whatever, like $10 for a card, and then they were allowed to make so many phone calls, but they did get a good discount. And so anyway, they would sit and cry, and they just found out they'd had a new baby because they hadn't seen their wife for about 6 months. And so anyway, after that, we would, when they were getting ready to go, we would clothe them. And I felt so proud of my grandson. He's a captain on one of the tugs out here. This one fellow was throwing one of the lines off the big ship, and his glove went with it. And, oh, the poor guy. So my grandson grabbed the glove off the line and held it, and he pointed it up to the fella. And the fellow was curtsying to him, you know. So anyway, when he got the ship tied up, he went aboard, and he said, here's your glove. And he says, where's the other? He said, I only have one, and just, you know, one. And this was in real early in the spring, when late in the last fall, and it was so cold. He only had one glove. So anyway, my grandson brought him over to the center. He told him, like, you know, I'll get the van and pick some of you boys up, come over and get some warm clothes. Well, we gave him, we got donated from us from this this co-op out here near the cheese farm. He donated, and it was about 12 pairs of leather gloves, you know, for those work gloves. And so we gave him a pair of those work gloves. You'd think we'd give him, and his tears are streaming down his face. He had two gloves, and he was just elated. And so anyway, we take them, if they're going to be in for any length of time, we take them for a ride, like Bob, when Bob was well, we take them out to the fort, and we bring them to the house. And this one day I brought them to the house, and it was a ship that had come in from India. And it was in the middle of the summer, so I said to him, I said, well, would you like to come to our house? We'll have a glass of wine. And he said, sure. So he spoke very good English. And so anyway, we gave him a glass of wine. He says, that's awful. And I said, is it? He says, yeah. Where you get it? And I said, I made it. Oh, that's worse.
Well, most of those ships, grain ships, the crews that you deal with?
Yes.
Can you predict which ones are going to be in trouble before you see them?
No. There was one. And oh, this was several years ago. They went out and they were inspecting this ship, and they were eaten alive with lice and bugs. And this fellow had rubber gloves on up to here when he was rummaging through. They even got in, and he was a mess. His neck and everything was just... So anyway, they wouldn't let him come in the port. So we went to Duluth. And he went on to Duluth, and so they, I think they were told, I'm sure they must have told Duluth that this ship, because it had to stay out there until we could get someone out there to fumigate them to clean it up, and they didn't want to wait. So anyway, when they got to Duluth, they wouldn't let them in either until they had this fumigated the whole ship, but they had to wait, but they had it done in Duluth. And and as far as drugs go, I know Greg had quite a time in Marathon. There was a ship came into Marathon, and they brought two dogs down because they knew they were pre-warned there would be drugs on this ship that would come in. And so anyway, he notified the OPPs. And the OPPs went down, and this was, my son was manager of the, district manager for his dad at that time. And so they went down, and with the dogs, and they sniffed the whole boat through, and they couldn't find anything. But evidently, I don't know where the ship went on to, but they did have drugs, and the dog didn't find them. But you know, the ships, the fellas on the ships cannot get off in the States. There's guards on the docks to make sure no one gets off. So that's the only place they can get off the ship for a little break is here in Canada.
Do any of these people jump ship? Do they become involuntary?
We haven't had any. We've never heard of that with the problem was when one of the men died on the ship, and they were from where were they from? Was it Yemen? When he died, we had a priest come aboard with our padre. And they went aboard, and they gave them, they pronounced him dead, but they couldn't send the body back because it was too costly. They couldn't afford it, and there's no way they could keep a body on board ship for, you know, several months, for a few months. So anyway, they did have him cremated and buried here. So his body is still buried here. And we've had several in the hospital. And fortunately, to find interpreters, you can pretty well find interpreters around for them because they have to be left here. And they will catch up with their ships later. I know it was so sad when that one man passed away because, of course, the company wouldn't have anything to do with him when he died. Forget about him, you know. We just don't have to pay them now.
Some of them men that worked on them, some of them ships from different countries, they never got paid hardly anything.
Oh, I know.
I heard they got paid $10.10 an hour.
I know. It's so pitiful. Yeah. You should read those magazines from the seafarers. It's just the most pathetic thing you ever saw. And those fellas, we went aboard one time. We've been invited aboard several times for dinner. We went aboard this ship from India, and anyway, of course, everything is that real spicy, curry.
Curry.
Oh, and I left, they have jugs of water all along, and I remember Bobby's, which one's the water, and he grabs the water, and he constantly drinking this water, and I said, why, and he said, you haven't ate that yet, have you? No, but they were so courteous, and then there was another ship from the Philippines that came in. It was Pakistan, and he he had his wife with him, and her name was Rose. And so anyway, the next day we're on duty. Bob and I were both on duty that day. So I said, well, let's go on the, when I go down, I said, I want to bring Rose, a rose and a vase. So I bought her a lovely yellow rose. And, oh, she was so excited about this yellow rose. So she took it back to her room. And so anyway, they were in for several days. They were waiting for different types of grain that they hadn't gotten. So anyway, the day before they left, we took them someplace up around Port Arthur and the, you know, around the bluffs and what have you. And here she pulled out a great big luncheon cloth, and her husband said she stayed up all night for two nights to finish that for you. Yes, she was such a kind woman. She couldn't speak English, but he interpreted for her. But it's so sad, because you get the fellas that come in and they have no money. So they get no pay, and sometimes they are left on their ships abandoned with no water and no food. And it just so happens that the seafarers come and provide. They bring on water for them, and the company won't have anything to do with them, and they won't pay them. And they abandon them. And there they are, left with nothing. And it's so pitiful, you know, to see them. And, you know, so often, if they see their children, maybe once in 3 years, because they go to different ports, you know. And they have no money to fly home or to get home to see their family. No way. And so it's really such a sad situation. In fact, you know, they're going to, I noticed this is our 100th year for the seafarers, and what they're going to do is they're going to, they've been trying and trying and trying. Of course, we can't get any backing. Everything's volunteer. And so anyway, we're really working hard to see if we cannot get more help for these seafarers. I'm not the seafarers, the people off the ships that are left from home. And then, in fact, we just got through bagging, we did 92 bags, you know, them Christmas bags about this big, and we give them out to the ships so that they, at the last few ships, we give them out to the crews. And of the last ship or the last two ships, so they have a gift to open on their way back to for Christmas. And in it, we put in handmade scarves and socks and toques and gloves and candy and wrap candies and shaving gear. And then with the women, you know, you get these little packages in with makeup, you know, in the stores. And what we do, we fill those up with soap and toothbrush and toothpaste and stuff like that. And we give them a little face cloth and a little towel. And they just love that. They don't use makeup and or perfume or anything like that. But we always make up the women a nice little package too, you know. And
are there lots of women in the crew?
Not on the crew. Not on the crew. It's their wives sometimes. The officers. The officers sometimes bring their wives.
I see.
And but you don't find any of the ratings.
No.
Bringing any women, no way.
This is a whole interview on its own, but I think we should shut it off now and perhaps come mm-hmm. back and get more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I have a very interesting book I have here too on...